The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and it's my great honor to be here tonight to introduce Reginald Dwayne Betts, referred to by the New York Times Book Review as a powerful work of lyric art and tour de force indictment of the carceral industrial state. Reginald Dwayne Betts' poetry collection, Felon, won the NAACP Image Award, the American Book Award, and was a finalist for the 2019 Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Also the author of two other poetry collections and a memoir, he received the 2019 National Magazine Award for his New York Times Magazine essay about his journey from prison inmate to becoming a graduate of Yale Law School and an attorney. His other honors include a Guggenheim Fellowship, a 2021 MacArthur Genius Grant, and a Radcliffe Fellowship from Harvard. He's the founder and executive director of Freedom Reads, a not-for-profit institution devoted to providing greater access to literature in prison. Dwayne joins us tonight with his latest work, Redaction. Created in collaboration with visual artist Titus Kaffer, Redaction is a multimedia examination of the relationship between race and incarceration in America, specifically addressing the issue of cash bail, referred to by its authors as a journey through words and images meant to trouble. One review calls it a brilliant and original condemnation of racial injustice. Tonight, he'll be joined in conversation by Era D. Matthews. She is the 22-23 Philadelphia Poet Laureate and directs the poetry program at Bryn Mawr College. Her collection, Simulacra, won the 2016 Yale Series of Younger Poets Prize, and her work has appeared in New York Times, Best American Poets, Gulf Coast, Harvard Review, and VQR, among other journals. Her autobiographical poetry collection, Bread and Circus, will be published this spring. Philly, put your hands together and join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
Good to see everybody. Welcome everybody, and welcome our guest, Reginald Dwayne Betts. We have the opportunity to have a conversation tonight. We just realized that we go way back. We first met in, without knowing that we were meeting each other, 2008 in Detroit, where I'm technically from, or what I own as my hometown.
It was my first poetry reading.
It was your first poetry reading.
And it was, well, less people there than tonight.
But then we went to dinner afterwards and it was all worth it.
Yeah.
So welcome. Thank you for being here. Thank you for making. Thank you for this book. I thought we'd have a little bit of a conversation about the book tonight and how this beauty started.
Cool. It's a pleasure. You guys should get the book, like a show and tell. But this would be like when you would go to read when you were a kid and they would show you pictures. Because it's pictures, so I'll get to show you some pictures.
Exactly. Tell us a little bit about how this collaboration started. How did you meet Titus? How did it all start?
It's interesting, actually, because it's the way that we met, but then it's maybe our first artistic collaboration happened, actually, before we met. So I was commissioned by the Harvard Architectural and Design magazine to write a piece, and I thought that was strange because I didn't know that they wrote pieces. And in a design magazine, but I wrote a piece about, it was an essay that's actually in this, it's a short essay about carrying the letters of this guy who got executed in 2000. He was one of the last people to get executed for a crime they committed as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I was writing something and it was about him, but the piece ended up not being good really. But the point is I spent that whole semester carrying those letters around. And so when I was asked to write a piece, I wrote a short piece about the letters and this guy, Glenn. Titus was asked to contribute some art. And so he contributed a couple of pieces of the redaction pieces, not the redaction pieces, but the Jerome series pieces. Mm-hmm. So years later, after we did redaction together, I'm in his studio, and I was like, oh, yeah, I got that magazine. I'm pretty sure I'm in there. He was like, yeah, I'm in there too. What did you do? I was like, I can't remember, because... And it was one of those magazines that was in plastic, and so I don't even know if I opened mine. And I was like, what are you in there for? He's like, I can't remember. He asked me to do something. So we take the plastic off, and we open the book up, and they paired our pieces. His piece was like the intro to my piece. And so that's our first artistic collaboration, even though we didn't even know each other at the time. And I'm glad we didn't discover it until after we worked together, because we probably would have chosen like not to work together, because it would have felt like it was somebody else's idea. It's like, so you think we should work together. But anyway, years later, we were friends, and we would talk about artists and artistic collaborations with visual artists and people who deal with the word. But the biggest challenge is always, how do you make the words not be a substrate for the visual art, or the art not be a substrate for the words? And so we just kicked it back and forth, but we never thought about doing something. And it just so happens that I was tapping into working around redaction, which is, for me, thinking about how can you make a text more revelatory by getting rid of the words that are superfluous, mm-hmm. getting rid of the words to get in the way of the meaning. And also, I was thinking, how do you turn a complaint, a literally, you know, civil lawsuit is a complaint. And I thought, how do you turn it into the poetic version of a complaint? Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to use redaction lines to reveal this. And Titus had always worked visually with the like doubling of images, with the recognition that you could reveal more by making people want to slow down, with the taking a glimpse into what's behind the thing that you typically see. And so he invited me to this college out in Maine when he was in the print shop. And so he was trying something new, and I was trying something new, and it just ended up working together.
And then came this beauty eventually. And you said that it's been in a couple of different forms. So you've had this displayed, and it's been exhibited in museums, art galleries.
My house.
Your house.
Yeah, so what happened first is it was in MoMA PS1. It's a lot of people here, so don't everybody shout at once though. but who has actually seen the book? So it's only one person. So it's hard to have a conversation about an art object and talk about it in an abstract, and you can't actually see it. Who's familiar with a print, what a print is? Now, I wasn't familiar with what a print was, and so it was a learning process for me, and I learned a lot when we were working on this. Titus is doing etchings, and I won't ask you who's familiar with an etching is. I'll just say that it's like drawing on a piece of sheer plastic with a really sharp pencil, mm-hmm. on like sharp blade. And then later what you do is you wipe the plate with ink, and then the ink settles into the crevices, and then you put it down on a sheet of paper, and you use some one of those things that you flatten dough with. But this one has like 300 PSI or something. Mm-hmm. But you basically transfer the lines from the plate to the page. And it's really lovely, because you could get these really, really detailed line work. And typically they don't do etchings on black paper, and they don't do prints on black paper. So me and Titus decided to use black paper. We did two etchings, and then we did two silk screens. One silk screen was just the words, and one silk screen was just the letters. We turned these into prints, and we had an exhibit at MoMA PS1, and we had an exhibit at Next Haven, and we called this the third exhibit of redaction, and I'll tell you why in a second. But the thing that you'll see when you grab the book is that it's sort of three redaction sections, mm-hmm. that have all of the redaction pieces from the show. The first page, the first four pages, allow you to just see how that printmaking process I just talked about gets deconstructed. So right now, this is like the whole print. And then you take one page away, and you see the words. And then you take the next page, and you can see the words, and you can see the face behind it. You take the next page, and you see one face. And then you turn the next page away, and you see the last face. And then when you turn the next page, you see how the four pages come together to make one print. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we were struggling with is, and it's on the wall is bigger than this, and everybody doesn't have wall space for this like 30 by 25 inch print. But also to consume the whole thing, it's 50 prints. A lot of prints, the sort of number in the edition is less. we wanted to do 50 because we were starting with the idea of these poems. Mm-hmm. And so the poems collectively were like 20-some pages. And then we just had some other things that we built into the show as well. But you also see when you get the book is that, like, you don't see my name at the bottom. You don't see Titus's name at the bottom. And then when you turn the page, it's not an image on the other side. Because, you know, we conceptualize this book as a work of art. And so each of the redaction prints is a redaction print, you know, and with the notion that some people will deconstruct it and they will frame it. They will frame multiple copies. Some people will buy multiple copies and they will just hold one as a work of art in and of itself. And then they would think about the other one as something that they deconstruct to give art to friends. Because, you know, one of the things the whole work was premised on is this notion that you have a show and it's that moment PS1 and it's amazing. But only the people who know about it being that moment PS1 can go mm-hmm. see it. And then if they are in another state, and they even if they do know about it, they might not be able to get there. But when you turn it into a book like this, and when you try to make attention to the details, like having three different kinds of paper, like having it be cloth bound, the idea is it is your opportunity to experience the third exhibition of the redaction prints.
Exactly. And something that's interesting about the soft bound is that it can go inside. So you can take a softbound book where you can't take a hardbound book inside. And so it feels like it's an important part of this because it's telling a story that's relevant for people who are inside or who are incarcerated. And then you've made it accessible for those folks as well.
Well, the first two readings I read from it have been in prisons in New York. Mm-hmm. And at the last time I was reading, you know, I was telling them the story about why it was softbound. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, you know, we didn't want to create this beautiful thing. Because, and typically art books and coffee table books like this, mm-hmm. typically they don't have art in it. I mean, they don't have poetry in it, so they're not as good as this one.
poetry makes everything better.
But the other thing also is that, you know, it does really just live on the table often. I like to think that this makes you want to pick it up and like look at it. Mm-hmm. But I also think it becomes something different because each one of the pieces, the redaction prints, each poem is like a haiku. So it's not as if you got to read all of it at once, and it's just so many different places to step into it at.
Absolutely, so. Absolutely. I was thinking about going back to when we were first introduced, and I was thinking about when I had a private introduction to your full-length work, which was with Shahid Reads His Own Poem. And as with all of your work, in my view, there's a refusal to allow the disappearance of the incarcerated or the formerly incarcerated. And so the idea that you move into redaction seems to layer that even more, where there's this idea where there's a refusal to let these people be disappeared. There's a refusal to let these demands be disappeared in some way. And in fact, the beginning epigraph to redaction reads, "A journey through words and images meant to trouble, a poet and a painter refuse to let them black hole the process." And then as we move through the collection to page 149, I was wondering if you'd be interested in reading that.
149. Oh, I didn't know this. Comes with this cool red ribbon.
Yeah, it does.
That you can use to save your place. I mean, this is like the Bible. "You forget America's stories, then behold this process. How we avoid letting anyone pigeonhole this process. My God, what's left when all the weeping's done? Whose mother believes art will console this process? In museums, only the gods looked like his kin. Why would Kafar let the market control this process? My brother said you and your man mastered the hustle. I told him only our sweat would bankroll this process. Material, tar and regret, where others forget, a knife against canvas, ready to charcoal this process. Maybe it's the tension between the world and me. Should I reveal this black soul, this process? Our journey through words and images meant the trouble. Shahid and Titus refused to let them black hole this process."
Mm-hmm. How does the work clear the path for people to see what they've refused to confront?
Well, you know, it's interesting too, because I mean, in some very real ways, a lot of my work is about prison, but a lot of my work is about prison in a way that prison is a metaphor for what it means to be alive in the world. And Mm-hmm. And when you talk about what this book is about and what the work is about and how do I work to not let people become invisible that I feel like I sometimes disappear by our system. I mean, part of it is I think this book is a story of family. I think this book is a story of community. And I think one of the ways that we don't understand incarceration is as a story of family. Mm-hmm. We like to believe that we understand it as a story of injustice. And I think that is true. But as a story of injustice, it gets to exist as a thing that actually doesn't shift considerably. So when we talked about 2000 and between the year 2000 and now, it's been a radical change in public consciousness about the system, mm-hmm. but it hasn't been real radical change in the system mm-hmm. itself, or not as much as we need or we might demand. And I think part of that is that we don't think about folks' lives as whole. We think about their lives as just a sliver of a representation of some kind of injustice that feels impossible to truly, truly overcome. And so when we think about it, we don't think about the stories of people. And I think that's what I tried to do with this book. It's all of the poems. It's about community. It's about family. It's about dealing with disaster. And even the redaction poems, I often tell stories that people don't hear. This was a 38-year-old mother of two. Mm-hmm. This was a 50-year-old disabled man. He lived with his children. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's telling the story of that life that actually gets erased sometimes when we think about the system.
Yeah. And when you think about the system, you can't help but think about time. And so I was really curious about the ways that you've marked time in the book itself. So the book opens with the first section titled Archive, in which you entered the conversation discussing the Three-Fifths Compromise and the Constitution. And then a page later, you enter into the letters from Glenn McGinnis, who you referenced earlier, who was executed in January of 2000. And for me, that time marker signals the beginning of a nation and the end of the human. So I'm wondering how, one, I was hoping that you might read that short essay about Glenn. And second, I was hoping that you might be able to answer some of the questions about how you document time. It feels like you enter into the text and it feels as if no time has passed, but you know that time has. How are you documenting time?
That's a series of really good questions, none of which I thought of. Like, when I was writing this book, that's exactly the thing I was thinking about. Before this, I said I have no interest in knowing your questions beforehand. Such a mistake. You know, one of the things that's beautiful, though, about this is this constant juxtapositions that happen. So it's both mm-hmm. poem with art, yes. but it's poems with each other. Yes. And you really just took a two-poem arc to say something about time. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it makes all of the sense in the world because you go from Crispus Attucks mm-hmm. to Glenn McGinnis. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the passage of hundreds of years. And it frames this ultimate question that I'm trying to deal with. What is the story of incarceration? It's the story of incarceration and through line from, you know, colonial oppression to the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Is that what the through line is, or is it more complicated than that? And if we say that that's the through line, do we leave something out? Are we missing something? And redaction tries to answer that question, yeah. but it tries to answer it with words and art. So I'm going to read both of these just because I want to read this and just drop where I got this line from. Yeah. If you know where this line comes from, but you got to know the illusion. I can't tell you what the illusion is. You got to hear it and be like, I know what this is. It's like if you hear somebody say, I got debts no honest man could pay. Who said that? Y'all don't know who said that? I got debts no honest man can pay. Said it twice. One album. Thank you. So, all right, I'm going to read these two poems. I'm going to read the Crispus Attucks one. And this is the art that goes with the Crispus Attucks poem. In Crispus Attucks, two dead eyes, vacant as a Confederate soldier's, empty as some stories of tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And every tomorrow somehow its own chronicle, each spill more lovely and devastating than the last. And tell me, the story of the eyes of some dead man refusing to be a witness. And oh Lord, this democracy, this becoming these amendments that metamorph to Kafka's pet. Some euphemism for longing, for firearms, for death, for loss, for this suffering. Three-fifths, the whole person, three-fifths, and Indians may be excluded from this union, respective of numbers, apportioned, all three-fifths Indians, three-fifths not free persons, Indians not free, bound to service, and Crispus, whose body bled for this democracy, becomes a jeopardy question. And, oh, Lord, this democracy, this wool-gathering confession, not Indian but Mohegan, Mojave, Manhattan is a Lenape word, not three-fifths and abundance in history, and Crispus caught a bullet with his patriotism. His dead body counted first, as if being counted is a prerequisite to freedom for this America and its graveyards of naming. Now, if you get the illusion, you get a free book. And this book ain't that expensive, but it's more expensive than I would give you for free. It's so bad, though, like when you steal another poet's line and people don't get it because you did this cool thing like match your shoestrings to your shirt, right? And nobody knew it, you know, and it's like, man. And then if they like the line, you feel even more guilty because you're like, man, they don't even like me for me. You know, they like me for this person. But I'll tell you, because this is a good friend of mine, the line is from Natalie Diaz, and it's Manhattan is a Lenape word. And it's interesting, though, because, you know, when you think about time, it's like, whose time are you thinking about?
Right.
I was reading Victor Lavelle's book, new book, and it was talking about how they were giving black folks, letting them become homesteaders in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And they was telling them, come colonize these lands. It's like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. You know, what part of the history do we complicate for ourselves when we think about where we position against some horrible hardship and tragedy that's occurred? I'll read this one. This was long. I got excited because poets don't get to read this long. That's why I threw some of this in here. But during my second, and so this is the artwork that accompanies it. During my second semester at Yale Law School, I carried around the letters of a dead man. I began to think of them as small pieces of the prison cells that once held him. The letters were for Glenn McGinnis, executed on January 25th, 2000, for the murder of Letta Wilkerson. And all I know of her is the bullet from McGinnis that killed her. Every memory of a murder burying so many, a tempest, all of it. And the letters convey every emotion but fear, mostly. In a time of one-sided correspondence came to symbolize my own terror, that prison would be the shadow I carried into my death. That semester, I took Professor Stephen Bright's capital punishment course. Before then, my knowledge of death ran row consisted of McGinnis's letters and a story from my time at Sussex One State Prison. From the pull-up bar, I couldn't help but hear a young man new to the compound talking to a friend locked in a cell that faced the yard. The window in the cell was no wider than the palm of my hand, no longer than the length of a tall man's arm. I watched them trying to communicate. They weren't talking as much as yelling and reading each other's lips. The new guy asked his friend when he was getting out. The response, I'm on death row. For men on death row, leaving a cell is not a move toward freedom, but one toward death. McGinnis committed murder at 17. Ellis Unit 1 at the Texas State Penitentiary became his home. His letters became a way to escape the cell that held him. These letters speak to the desperation that comes with being haunted by the specter of death. Many begin with poems. I don't dare start thinking in the morning. I don't dare start thinking in the morning. Another begins, my luck is short like dust. Neither poems nor the letters dwell on the small details of a death sentence, the hours in a cell thinking of ways to save yourself, the fear of friends' executions, the waiting for word from the governor, waiting for the miracle that rarely comes. Neither everything about a prison can be hidden in a letter. McGinnis's letters bury his sadness, but sometimes it comes through. Mr. K told me that my appeals have been exhausted, and he has no hope for me of getting off death row. The letters in my bag reminded me again how legal theories can hasten death. Prisons are places where possibility goes to die. But the lives men live and the letters they write push against that. I cannot disconnect the cell from the letter. Back then, we called letters kites, as if ambition and hope alone could give a word wings. And it was true, words could escape the darkness of the cell. The paper, the envelopes, the very ink used to scratch those words into existence carries with it the funk of prison and the memory of a jail cell. McGinnis's letters collapsed the inexorable distance between me and prison, relics from all cells that he had served time in. His letters allow me to think of the prison's architecture as defined by the words that escape, and still the details haunt. In a letter where McGinnis talks about his appeals being exhausted, he writes, I apologize for not being able to write you a more gracious letter.
prison snuffs out light. This is what I know. From a cell, you begin writing about your troubles and realize the burden of your words, and so you hold back. McGinnis's letters came to me nearly a decade after they were written, when he was already dead. They made me see how much I held back all the pain and the anguish. His letters came before I decided to go to law school, before I could possibly understand their legal implications, what it means to be sentenced to die for a crime you committed as a teenager. On the last day of class, Professor Bright played a video of Steve Earle's Ellis Unit 1. Earl had become a correctional officer in a Texas state prison before becoming a country singer. McGinnis's letters were in my backpack, in the same way that men scratch their names, their lives on cell walls to remind people that they were there. He etched part of his life in letters. In 2005, the Supreme Court ruled in Roper v. Simmons that executing people for crimes committed before they turn 18 violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. If McGinnis had been on death row in just about any other state in the country, his appeals would have been taken a few years longer, and he would have lived to see the Supreme Court decision. Today, only his letters are left, his letters and memories.
Thank you. It's gorgeous. There is a line in there where you take out a line from one of McGinnis's letters, and it talks about light. And so this next question is really hitting on these ideas of light and texture inside the text. So when the reader gets to the second section, which is redaction one, they're encouraged to shift their mode of understanding, their mode of reading, and kind of understanding the deep structures of incarceration. But more than that, before the incarceration, the deep structures of the system itself. And so we're more fully entered into the erasure, and there's clearly two types in that redaction section, where there's the transparent page, you talked about it earlier, there's a transparent page where you interact with the textual absence and what's left behind. And then there is what happens in the layered illustrations of the human subject. So Titus's layered illustrations that are juxtaposed with the opacity of a dark page. So I'm kind of wondering how light, darkness, layer, and texture further complicate the argument about human captivity.
Yeah, this is interesting, because this is truly a question that I'd be like, Titus, you got that one? but you know, one thing that's interesting is by using black paper, I think that was already something I was trying to add, like depth and texture,
mm-hmm.
and do some of what the work of the images try to do,
yeah.
Which is just to say that typically prints are on white paper, but also by putting the prints on black paper, it troubles what it is that you think you see. Because if you were to assume that all of the etchings were black folks, then you would be making a mistake. And it's an argument in some ways that the black of the page brings in more light, because it becomes a conduit for revelation. You have to look closely. And the closer you look, you'll be able to find, you know, your own signals of the way in which the person reflects somebody back to you that reminds you of an aunt, of a cousin, of a sister. And that's no matter who you are. And one of the reasons why that happens, I think, is because of the way in which the image is interacting with the story. A 23-year-old woman, mother of two, police officers came, arrested her. She owed the city. Officers took away her two children. And if you hear out those words and you see that image and you don't think about some connection to yourself, then I think it's a real challenge to your humanity that the book is helping to be a bridge for. And then and I think finally, you know, we think about light, and the center of the pieces are the eyes. The eyes are what lets you see that you're looking at more than one person. And the reason why Titus is thinking about redaction as a way to reveal as you conceal mm-hmm. something is typically when you look at somebody's mugshot, you completely reduce them to your understanding of the trope of the mugshot.
Mm.
So by doubling images, one, it pulls you closer, and two, I think you begin to recognize something more complicated by seeing that you have to look closely to even disentangle who these two people are.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that attention becomes an act of generosity.
Right. And there's a sense of a deeper look inside the entire collection, because I'm thinking about how it's in conversation with 2019's Felon, which precedes this endeavor, of course, but you have poems like In Alabama, In Houston, In California, In Felon, and I'm curious to know how those redactions kind of deepened your engagement with this collection.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was the center of it in a way, though, because, you know, the prints themselves were based on those poems.
Right.
And that work, though, was also based on me thinking about, it's a lot of work about incarceration, but I don't think we always know what we mean when we try to, like, really pinpoint what bothers us. And this work was about people being incarcerated for money bail. Excuse me. And what was great about it is it was a way to step back and think about the problem of the system in a discrete area. And these are people who are being incarcerated and often being released, but they've been incarcerated for some period of time because they owe traffic tickets, because they owe fines, because they couldn't pay small bills. And so ultimately, everybody from these lawsuits was like at home when the lawsuit settled, because these are people that's doing, you know, between 2 days a day, a week, and 6 months. But, you know, it's hard to even understand the tragedy of that if you're a layperson. And so I had the documents, and I was like, no, I was like, really, people want to read this. This is great. And then I realized that it was a civil lawsuit and class action and 50 pages of dense legalese. And, like, nobody wanted to read it ever, you know. And so the first thing was, like, how do I make this sing? How do I make it a poem? And the reason why it relates to this book is because those prints and those poems became a crucial part of the prints with Titus's art. But then this book became a way to use this as a vehicle to say something about our broader work. And so you see a lot of Titus's work where he has these historical photos. You see a lot of his work where he has other types of, where he makes use of other principles of redaction. You see his color work. And some of the stuff you see and you won't even know, you won't even recognize certain things about it because it's an inside conversation. So so for instance, I think it precedes this. So this piece right here, it's called Enough About You, and it's the reproduction of this famous piece that was hanging up at Yale, and it was like these three white men talking, and this little kid beside them that was like the servant person that was like meant to be seen as an object of history, but really not meant to be seen. And so both in real history, he was meant to be there but not seen.
Right.
But then in the reproduction of the painting, it reproduced that same quality because the people that you focused on in the painting were, again, not this boy, but the people he was, quote-unquote, serving. Now, what Titus did was he redid it and then balled it up and called it Enough About You and framed the boy in a piece. But the boy is my son. My son, he painted my son for this piece. And so it says something to me that, like, nobody else publicly will really know because, you know, once you know that it's my kid, you'll recognize him. But it's my kid from when he was, like, seven. And so, you know, you won't even, you know, you just wouldn't recognize him. And so it's a way in which this whole conversation is messing around with time.
Yeah.
And this is a way out right here to go to your first question where Titus was messing around with time because he literally put, you know, 2016 in the artwork with, like, you know, 1860.
Right,
and then the poem that accompanies it is a poem that I wrote for my son. So I think that's another thing that's going on in terms of how those redaction pieces aren't just, you know, they do specific things as art, but they also say something in terms of being a symbol for our deepening partnership. And so it becomes a bridge in this because it lets us, like, do the same thing.
Yeah, and I just kind of want to play off that idea of your deepening partnership because although the book makes a compelling argument about the intermingling of privilege and capitalism and the justice system and how the Eighth Amendment is in peril under the current system, it also, and importantly, articulates a fuller narrative around Black malehood and tenderness in this really beautiful way. And I just wanted to ask you, why do you think that's an important narrative to forward in the dialogue around masculinity?
And I think, though, if we was going to translate that, it's like, you know, it's like, you wrote some dope-ass poems, though.
You did. That's what's up. You did.
And you know, but it was interesting, though. It's like, one of the things, it's really hard not to talk about my own work in comparison to things I did in the past, but you're always trying to improve it. And we do a lot of conversations about, like, I don't write for audience. And there's something precious about saying that, you know? And as a lawyer, you always know you're communicating for audience. And now I run a nonprofit called Freedom Reads, and I have to raise money, and I'm definitely communicating with the audience. Like, imagine if I'm about to ask you to donate to Freedom Reads, and I'm like, I mean, it is a lovely day outside. books are amazing. Oh, you should check out my organization at some point. And I leave, and my development person will be like, what exactly was that? You know, did you tell them about the work? Did you have a pitch deck? Did you have an ask? No, you were not communicating into an audience. You were communicating in space somewhere, but you had no intention. And I mention that because as a lawyer and sort of as a fundraiser, you know that you have to know who you're communicating to, and you have to have some sense of what you want them to walk away with. Now, mm-hmm. in raising money, sometimes people walk away with something else than you intend, but they give you money because because it's not didactic, is my point. And even the fundraising bit of it is not didactic. You want to open a room for them that they'll enjoy a lot of aspects of the room, and you want them to come into the room on their own. Mm. Well, when I was writing these poems, I was writing them particularly for all kinds of reasons, but the pandemic was going on. I wanted to grasp some joy. I was writing poems for a friend that was going through chemo, and so I just wanted... Then if you send in somebody a poem to them when they're going through chemo, it has to have light in the poem. You can't write a poem that is troubled by darkness, right? Or overwhelmed by darkness. And so I had a different intention when I was writing the work. And I think all of those things come out to be me being vulnerable. Because one way to have something in it that was complex was the struggle to be vulnerable. So that becomes a thing that allows it to have texture, and I think that allows it to have texture that's just slightly different from some of my other work, but it's also where you get the argument from about people in the system, that we are living full lives, and we are like striving to be members of a community in all kinds of complex ways, and not working to be reduced solely to the pain that we've caused others, solely to the pain that we've experienced for being in the system. Or from having family members or good friends.
Right on. Thank you so much for that. I want to open it up to the audience to see if there are any questions out there. I would be happy to hog the time with Reginald, but I want to make sure that you have the opportunity to ask any questions that you have. Any questions in the audience?
Dwayne, I don't know anything about poetry, but I know a little bit about legal writing. So I'm curious about, in legal writing, obviously you want to have clarity of idea and thought. And I imagine that part of the advantage of having a redacted poem along the lines of what you described is being able to clarify a lot of the complication that is inherent in legal writing. But I also know in legal writing you're rewarded for some of that complexity, either in demonstrating a particular complex idea or confusing the issue to your advantage. So I'm curious about, with your legal training, your legal writing training, the amount of writing that you have to do, how has that affected how you think, construct, and draft poems?
So basically, right, to translate the question, it's like, you know, being a lawyer trains you in some ways to be a really skilled liar. How you prevent yourself from approaching your more creative work with the same intentionality of a Supreme Court judge? Clerk. I honestly don't think that like the best lawyers truly believe something that they need to say. And this is why a lot of legal writing is not meaningful for the public, because you could deeply, and you know it, you just deeply mean that, believe that this statute is being violated or not. And you focus your attention on answering that question instead of answering the question about whether what will happen based on that determination, if it is just, if the things that will happen to people are just. Mm-hmm. But I think the skills are the same, though. So then as a writer, I'm thinking about how to do the same thing, you know, how to focus on, I had a dog, so some of these poems, I still have a dog, I have a puppy, she's two now, but when she was a little dog and we never had a dog before, I was experiencing all of these like black man in public with a dog things. And I mean, I was never more lovable in my life than when having this little white dog, you know. And people would know you because you're walking around your neighborhood. And it wasn't even, it was just because now all of a sudden they see you. They see you every day. You're the person who you actually do clean up after your dog. And you do it when people are watching and when nobody's watching, you know. Mm-hmm. Or they just see you being nice to other neighbors. But the point is, I was trying to notice those things because they were so new and so fresh to me. And sometimes in a deep noticing, the poem would turn somewhere else about what it means to be vulnerable. So it's the same, I think, thing as you do with legal writing, except I have more choices. I don't have to focus on a statue. I could focus on white peonies. I mean, we bought this house and we didn't know that it was a perennial garden, that the house is a perennial garden. So you wake up one morning and it's 100 tulips in your yard and you're like, I believe. You know, literally, you know, or like a peony, it's impossibly beautiful. And it's not announced that it's coming. You know, you just like, so this fool sold me some sticks? And then the next day they bloom and you like, what? And those will become poems. Mm-hmm. But it's because I could focus on those things. And as a legal writer, sometimes you don't get to choose what you would focus on. Mm-hmm. That's why one of the more creative things I saw was Brian Stevenson had a piece that was like an imaginary emotion. And he was like, I moved for the court to treat my 14-year-old client like they would an 85-year-old millionaire. And that was him breaking out of the legal form to focus on a different kind of question. It was actually pretty compelling.
Right on.
Question regarding Freedom Reads, and here you are speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I was originally introduced to you in your appearance, your award-winning appearance in 2020 on the podcast Econ Talk. And so with that introduction to Freedom Reads and you again being here now, the Free Library of Philadelphia, I was just wondering if you could speak to that harmony or disharmony.
Yeah, so it's so Freedom Reads is an organization that I started, and we build libraries and prisons. And it's a lot to that unpack. So first, a lot of prisons have libraries, but they tend to be libraries that are distant from where the population is. And so if you got a job, you might not be able to go. The library is open 9 to 5, so you can't go after hours. If you have other competing interests, you want to play sports, you want to exercise, you want to watch TV, you might not go to the library. But more importantly, it becomes a crew of folks that go to the library and you find your people. But what about learning what people you are? Mm-hmm. And so we want to put these libraries on the housing units. I recognize that it was a lot of legitimate reasons for people not to be able to go to the library, including the fact that if everybody wanted to take advantage of it every day, they wouldn't have the capacity to serve everybody. So I said, okay, well, let's build a library and put it on a housing unit. And then we would just take restraints and create opportunities. So the shelves couldn't be more than 44 inches high because of PREA, because of concerns of violence and mm-hmm. and getting in the way of sight lines. So we said, okay, we'll make it 44 inches, but why put it on the wall? You put a bookshelf on the wall, what you do is create an opportunity for one person to have a private moment with themselves. But what if we made it 44 inches and then we made it accessible from both sides mm-hmm. so it had to be in the center of space? Because if you've been into a prison, you know that you and you've seen like a bookshelf on a housing unit, it's like out of the way. It's where people go in a corner and they go look for books, but there's no community there.
Right.
And so we put our curve, and then we make them curved because, again, there's nothing curved in prison. It's just like straight lines and right angles. And we make it suggest the kind of softness that shapes communicate. And then we make them out of hardwood, out of maple, out of oak, out of cherry, out of walnut, because there's nothing in prison that is that beautiful, that is built to last that long, but it's also a symbol of life. It's also a symbol of compassion, of forgiveness. And so that was the idea. We make it 500 books because I think that you could like take a deep, deep journey into who you are by reading, you know, some even a subset of these 500 books, which is a mixture of, you know, a lot of poetry, classics, you know, your Faulkner, your Morrison, your James Baldwin. It's a run of detective novels, those first-person gritty detective novels that has, you know, your S.A. Cosby's alongside the Maltese Falcon, alongside Chester Himes. And so we started from this idea, and at this point we've done 90 libraries across 23 prisons in 8 states. And what's fascinating is we went from, like, people telling me you can't convince the DOC to do this to prisons calling us saying, you know, we really want those libraries on the housing units, because they recognize that it brings some calm, it brings huge opportunities, and it's just a moment. A woman, you know, a guy wrote me and said, in the 25 years I've been locked up, I've never seen anything this impactful happen. Mm-hmm. And when we was in this women's prison in California, this woman came up to me and said, you did this? I was like, I mean, I didn't do it by myself. I mean, I did drive the 18-wheeler from Connecticut to get here that the libraries were on. And I handmade these shelves, most of them. And I was like, no, of course I didn't do those things. I was like, but I've run it. And I'm making a joke, you know, and she's weeping. And she's trying to talk. She's like, I'm sorry. And that was kind of funny, but like, I'm sorry. Like, I just can't believe you've done this, you know. And she's standing in front of me crying. And so it's been pretty powerful and really impactful. And across our programs, what I really love, though, is we got this Freedom Ambassadors program where people come in with us. And they don't come in, you know, most organizations, if you've been inside a prison, I've been inside a bunch of them, you usually go in as a voyeur, even when you don't want to, even when you, you know, you're trying to go do good work and you're trying to study a problem. If you're not teaching and providing direct services, mm-hmm. In some way it feels voyeuristic no matter what, you know. Mm-hmm. And what I love about our work is you get to come in and it's just work. You know, if we do 18 libraries, we did 18 libraries at one prison, that's 4,000 books. And the books are set up in like library one, library two, library three, onward. But it's in boxes and it's in plastic, and you got to open those boxes and you got to take the books out of plastic. And so we bring people in with us who serve as ambassadors, and they do the work for the day, and they are in community with the COs. We got the pictures back from one of these spots, and you see like all of these smiling faces. And it's not that prison stopped being prison. Nobody believes it stopped being prison, but you can have a moment of joy around books. And when our model turns the books into a coffee table, and you don't sit across from somebody and they have coffee in their hand and you don't smile, you know? And so when you sit across from somebody and they got a book in their hand, you don't look at them and not speak, you know? And you just never know where the conversation might go. So we've been doing it, and obviously we still need support. Obviously, you could go to the website, www.freedomreads.org, to read more about the initiatives. But I'm happy to say it's fantastic, man. And it was a cat that used to send us $5 every month, a $5 bill, because he recognized that, you know what? This is halfway to a book right here. And this is what I could contribute every month. But it was symbolic, and it represented the same kind of initiative that folks have had when they've decided to give $10,000 or $20,000 or $50,000. And so, you know, if anybody sees this and you decide that you got an extra $25,000, go to www.freedomreads.org and hit donate.
I want to ask, if I may, about the short film that Titus made, Shut Up and Paint, that mm-hmm. you're heavily featured in. And there's a scene in that where you're kind of talking about your work perhaps being not as accessible as both of you would like, and that seems to be kind of the premise of him wanting to make a film in the first place, and more people can see it than can go to an art gallery or something like that. I'm just curious if you have thoughts on how that conversation may have evolved and what your feelings and thoughts are on that now.
Yeah, I mean, so I tell people, like, we made this book, and the book has price point that's higher than most hardback books. It's $100 a book. But I tell them why they should get two copies. Mm-hmm. I say you get one copy, and you take these prints, and you deconstruct them, and you frame them, and you give them to the people that you love. I tell them you can't afford a Titus Kaphar print. And you can't afford 50 of them. And if you can, you should buy 50. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is an opportunity to bless other people with this story. Mm-hmm. And the way that I wrote the poems is that each print is its own haiku. Each print is its own poem. It's not a haiku technically, but it's haiku-ish. Mm-hmm. But I say that so that you don't have to feel like you have to have a whole sequence on your wall to get something. You don't. The second thing I say, and I think we think seriously about like audience and accessibility, is accessibility in two ways. So one, accessibility is just like, can you reach it? You know, is the museum outside of, you know, the circumference of your everyday activities? Mm-hmm. And often that is, even if you live in a city where the museum is. So the book addresses that accessibility in some way. Because you could hold this, you could pick it up from the store. Every time, you know, us being on Good Morning America, two black men on Good Morning America talking about art, right? It's also a powerful gesture to say that, you know, part of accessibility is winning the attention battle. And so that's the first part. But the other part is accessibility in terms of content. And I think that our work has been deeply complex and deeply accessible at both at the same time, and I think work can do that. So I think the poems are rich. They're rich with illusion. They're rich with depth, and I think they're rich with story as well. And because I'm more of a narrative poet, I think that helps my work become accessible on multiple levels to people. Mm-hmm. Just because we crave story and we want to hear stories, and I know that these poems are like deeply interesting and meaningful ones. So we'll see, but the jury is out. You know, we're doing our work. We're trying to say, come check this out. I'm trying to say, you know, truly, one of the questions was like, you know, we don't got a packed audience today. I was like, I don't care. I love the people who showed up. Mm-hmm. If it was seven people here, am I going to rock the house for the seven people that showed up? You know, because ultimately that accessibility bit and winning the attention battle, part of that is just showing up. And with Freedom Reads, we say the first metric of success is showing up. People don't show up to prisons. You know, sometimes artists don't show up to spaces to make sure that their work could get heard because it's sometimes a hassle. You know, sometimes you do get disappointed if you don't have a lot of people in the audience. But if you recognize that showing up is the first metric for success, then I think you could, you know, keep getting at that attention battle and maybe win it.
First, I want to thank you. I've enjoyed your talk, and I enjoy the genuineness of what you share. There is an incredible honesty to the presentation that I find refreshing. So I've been listening to you, both of you, actually. That was for both of you. Your questions were spot on, and I have enjoyed that. So thank you. I come away just being introduced to you. Well, not just, but in the last few months or so. So your body of work I'm unfamiliar with. Your pedigree or lack thereof I'm unfamiliar with. I'm looking at your book. I'm listening to what you tell me. And I'm wondering, what is it that you want people to come away with after they have gone through redaction? Or is the focus to be the prison industrial complex and how that impacts a community? Is the issue that within the community, there within this specific community, there is both passion, intensity, and art? Is it all of those things or none of those things? Mm-hmm. When they get to the end of your book, and they've taken this journey with you, where should they be?
So this is, thank you. That's a lovely question. So this is the last poem in the book. This brother is dancing in the city. His bald head, the only sun some of us will see on this winter day. His body draped in the colors of heaven, and each limb living in every burrow at once. How I've wanted to be free. When I tell my son about this brother and how a scar from his forehead to his lip was not nearly the most interesting thing about him, I think of his feet and wonder how to be that kind of honest, inventing within the moment everything that matters. I want to be somebody's child again and young enough to stand before a mirror until my body memorizes moves I believe may save me. Maybe nothing saves us, save being witness to someone else moving so free. I think the thing I find complicated about the question is the thing that people find challenging about poetry. In every collection of poetry, unless it's just a unified narrative, it is usually not one story, not 100 stories, but exponentially more stories than there are even poems. And that poem was written for Michael K. Williams. Now, when you get the book, you'll notice that the poems don't have titles on it because the art doesn't have titles on it because they always had this works listed section. And I was like, my poems are art too. I'm not putting my titles up there. This is a work listed, you know? And what's interesting is in that way, the poems become a sequence. They become an unnamed and unnumbered sequence that all tell these thousand stories but suggest that there is a connection that runs through these stories. And I think about that last poem as an exemplar because that's a poem that I wrote on the night of my 42nd birthday. You know, we had dinner, whatever, we went out, and I had saw this video of Michael K. Williams. And he was on, he was dancing in the park, and I didn't know he could dance. I knew he was an actor, and I seen all his work, and I had actually met him a few months before. I interviewed him for a podcast about democracy. And so we had like chopped it up, and I knew him. And so on my birthday, I had saw this video, and I was thinking about this video because I can't dance at all. It got real too. I got somebody wanted me to write a piece about it. I wrote like a 3,000 word piece about this, and I got a dance instructor, and I was learning how to do the dance from the clip. You know, I had this woman that was teaching me. I could do it too. I'm not, but I could.
I had my kids come. They came with me to one of the dance lessons, and dancing is exhausting if you're over 40 and your knees hurt. You know, you get to minute 32 and you like. But the point is, I write this poem for them because I'm searching for something beautiful to say to somebody else that's going through something. And then it crushed me when he passed, and I had forgot that I wrote that poem. And I was supposed to write a piece about somebody. And I realized that the times that he had passed and somebody had to write about him. And so I called the folks and I was like, no, I got that one. And I remember writing a piece and then spending a lot of time arguing with him about, like, would I say that Michael K. Williams overdosed in the piece? And I was like, I'm not saying that. You don't have to say that. Mm-hmm. And we went back and forth. But the point is I ended up ending from an image about, you know, his feet being in every burrow at once. And then months later, as I'm finishing redaction, I find this poem that I have wrote just on my phone that had the line in it. And I was like, this is a good poem. And we ended up putting it in a book. So what I want people to walk away with is the way in which some subset of these exponential stories that get contained in the poems and contained in the art speaks to their life. Because it's not just a book about the criminal justice system. But it's like when you were a kid and you had an encyclopedia and you had a one-volume encyclopedia and you could get endless days of delight by just looking up things and studying them and discovering them and you hadn't known before you picked up that encyclopedia. This literally is like an encyclopedia. And the subject is the creativity of Titus Kaphar and Reginald Dwayne Betts. It is like looking into the minds into our minds, and to the degree that we have interesting things to say about the world, that gets captured both visually and through words. And it gets captured in a way that offers you, I think, something as deeply engaging for those who are nerds as an encyclopedia. And even if you're not a nerd, you know, like the first encyclopedia I read, the first book I read was a basketball encyclopedia, and I would use the moves on the street. So even if you're not a nerd, you could use these moves in here in your life, whether you're in the courtroom or the boardroom, or, you know, so.
Thank you for that. I think I'll end on one last question that I'll ask you. Can you give us all tips in life about how to move from brutality into beauty?
Oh, this is perfect for this poem. The other thing that happens, right, is people can ask you questions, and you just flip pages and stop on a poem and be like, this would answer it, you know? So this is the image, right? And then I'm going to read the poem that goes with it. The image is a woman who's standing in the middle of two shrouded figures, and then it's also a painting in the back that has three people that look like they're fleeing. And are they fleeing towards freedom? And it's this riff on a woman who is going to be doing what she needs to do to protect her family. And so you could get multiple readings even of that work, even like subtle things, because it looks like it's a shadow of a man here who might be the threat that she has the gun for. It's a lot going on in Titus's work. It makes it really fascinating. But so part of my answer is, if you remember this, which is that this is the thing in the poem, that's one way to hold something gentle and vulnerable and safe in a world that is so often desperate and violent. A group of almost anything has a name. Crows are murder and flamingos are flamboyance. Most of the others I don't know. A group of empty shot glasses is called a disaster. Of empty rooms, a yesterday. A collection of tomorrows, even if dreamed, if desired, craved for like some small child wanting one more story at bedtime, is called hope. Too many nights when all I had was hope. No collective noun exists to hold all the people you love. If we name it at all, wouldn't it be abundance? I have an abundance of loves, and even when I am lonely, especially then, they show up. It rains outside and inside. Everyone I love sleeps. There is no word for listening to them breathe. But if there were, it would be the antithesis of murder. Crows always remember a face, is what I read once, and can recall it as if a part of a dream. And so I've always thought a house full of loves is a dreaming. And what better word for listening to all your loves breathe at night than a dreaming? What more could any of us ask of the dusk?
Thank you so much. Thank you, Philadelphia, for coming out to hear Reginald Dwayne Betts. It's been a beautiful night, an intimate night, if you will. A dreamy night. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your love with us tonight. We appreciate you.
My pleasure. Thank you guys for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.